Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 169. My guest this week is one of the best guests I've ever had. It's an astounding episode. I'm joined by Suad McHennett, who, if you don't know of, you very much will shortly. She's, yeah, this conversation... Where to begin? Really, I have to just let it play out. But honestly, you're gonna I love this. Before we get into it, I should say thank you for downloading our last week's episode. I had Eddie Izzard on last week, and it's one of the most popular episodes we've done so far this year. So that's good. And I've got a lot of good ones coming up. I've got Hugo White from the Maccabees next week, which is fantastic. I've lined up two or three that are the biggest guests I've ever had. But I'm not going to tell you about them until they're absolutely confirmed. But things I will tell you about is, as this goes out on Wednesday, tomorrow night, Thursday, the 21st of September, I'm doing the first ever live Distraction Pieces podcast in Ireland, in Dublin, at the Tivoli Theatre. It's going to be great. It's going to be you lot asking questions. In fact... shall I announce my secret guest? Because it's only a day to go. So this will only be for the people who listen on the first day of release. Right, don't tell anyone. But it's not 100% confirmed anyway. But I might be having a blind boy from the Rubber Bandits come on stage for a little chat. I will be having Stu and Chris come on stage for a little chat. And I will be having all you lot come on stage for a little chat to ask questions, engage... and be part of the podcast. I'll also be telling you some stories and stuff. So, yeah, it's going to be a good time. But what we've added, good Lord, what we've added is the next night on Friday the 22nd at 11:30 in the evening at the Social Club. I think it's just called the Social Club. It's on my Instagram and that. We're doing the first ever live hardcore listing drunk cast. So Chris and Stu are coming with me to Ireland. We're doing a drunk cast in Ireland with a crowd there. To engage with and discuss and drink with. We're going to be doing it as a hardcore listing because that means that we can get a bit drunk beforehand. Because the drunk cast is often 5 hours, we can't do a live show of that. So we'll have a few drinks beforehand and then we'll prepare some top fives to go through and we'll get the audience involved and it'll be a blooming mess in all likelihood. So that's going to be fun. And then, so that's at 11 o'clock on Friday, right? 11 o'clock on Friday is when we start. We then get a few hours sleep and then we're on a like 8 o'clock flight home to the UK to do our club night at the book club, We Are Lizards. It's the penultimate one of the year, a second from last. We've got Huey Morgan coming to spin some tunes. It's going to be amazing. It's looking like it's going to be a rammed one. So if you fancy coming along, pop your names, send names to info@thetrashsociety.com and you'll get on the queue jump list because it gets a bit hectic and mental. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Is that everything to tell you about? I always have to mention speechofelementrecords.com, but we're on a bit of a gap. I'm launching new winter merch very soon, Dark Winter. The dark summer stuff's still up there and still ticking over. But, I mean, speechofelementrecords.com, as I've mentioned before, we've also got, as well as merch, we've got vinyl and CDs, which people don't know about anymore. A CD is an old form of listening to music. It's called it stands for car disc. And it's because people put these CDs into their cars and listen to albums. So if you'd like a car disc of any of the... Of the releases on Speech of Venom Records, then check that out. I think that's everything I need to tell you. Let me tell you about this episode. It's with Suad McHennett, and she's got a book out called They Told Me to Come Alone, and it's just been nominated for the Bailey Gifford Prize, which is huge. And this is a painfully timely episode because there was a terror attack in London last week. As I record this, I'm recording this on the Saturday. There was a terror attack in London yesterday. It was a fairly unsuccessful terror attack, but a terror attack nonetheless. And Suad is one of the world's leading journalists on on terrorism, on foreign affairs, on these, on everything that's going on around the world. And she's uniquely positioned, being a Muslim immigrant that grew up in the West, is really an amazing position to get a handle on all this. And this was, as I've said, I mean, you'll hear in this podcast, there's a few points where I have to remember that I'm doing a podcast and not just listening to a podcast, if that makes sense, because so much of what she was saying was just blowing me away, and it should be getting to the end of a story and I'd be like, oh shit, I meant to engage and talk and say stuff, but I was just so blown away and in awe of what she's done and the risks she's taken. It's amazing. Please share this one if you can, guys. I think it's a really important one, particularly with everything that's going on at the moment. It's wicked when we have guests like Eddie Izzard and Will Poulter and Aisling B and loads of these huge stars, and they get huge numbers. Everyone shares it. The Goldie episode, when people thought we'd uncovered Banksy. Wicked, man. I love all the extra downloads. I love the attention that gets. But these are the episodes that make Distraction Pieces what it is to me. It's the episodes of people that you might not have heard of, but you should. And discussing things and educating me most of the time on things that I needed to be educated on, and maybe a few other people need to be educated on too. So, yeah, I sincerely hope that you enjoy this, and I hope even more that you use your social media and your social circles to push this episode and encourage people to listen to it and gain a greater understanding of some very complex subjects, if we're honest. Anyway, I'm going to stop rambling. I'll pop back at the end, obviously, to remind you of numerous things. But yeah, this is episode 169 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the amazing Soad McHennett. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm joined today by Soad McHennett. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's lovely to chat. This came about because Josh Weller brought you to my attention. It's a weird one. When you've got a podcast, everyone always has someone that they want to recommend, and that'd be good. And you generally have to politely kind of go, okay, but I've got guests I lined up. I've got it covered. And as soon as I started to do as some research on your book and on your career in general, yeah, I said to Josh instantly, like, yeah, we need to make this happen. So I'm glad you've got time to sit down and have a bit of a chat.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here, and yeah, it's amazing to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, so it's when I was planning this, there's so much I want to talk about. Obviously, you've got your new book, I Was Told to Come Alone. And it tells a lot of the stories of your life and of your career. And I was trying to think of the best way to start this, and it feels almost lazy to start at the beginning, but it's the thing that I realise is so key to position you as the right person to look into some of these things. So actually, just at the beginning, I'll just mention that you're an award-winning journalist, and with at the Washington Post, you've covered a lot of terrorism and that area for years. But you grew up in Germany, right?
Yeah, I did.
So let's kind of start there. What was your upbringing in Germany?
Sure. So yeah, I was actually born as the daughter of so-called guest workers. I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but
no.
So there was a time in Germany after the war where German companies were looking for people who could do some of the jobs that where they needed people, yeah. Workforce, and so they hired, or they went into certain countries and were looking for people to work in Germany, especially from Turkey, former Yugoslavia, Italy, Spain, yeah. And those were called guest workers.
Right,
and,
right.
My parents are coming from two different countries. My mom is from Turkey, from the Turkish-Syrian border region.
Right,
and
right.
My dad from Morocco, and they both met in Germany and fell in love there and got married. So I was born as the daughter of so-called guest workers in Germany.
Yeah.
And grew up in a very nice neighborhood. It wasn't really the neighborhood we would usually be able to afford. But my dad was a chef, and his boss lived in that building in Klettenberg Street, number 8.
Yeah.
And he also had like a rooftop apartment, which again was in this very nice neighborhood, but it was, if we could say so, a crappy apartment because it would rain in.
Right.
And I remember how my mom had to, you know, pull out buckets and make sure that it wouldn't rain on our beds.
Wow.
So yeah, we were a little bit the outsiders in that neighborhood because we weren't like the kids of managers or rich people.
The cheap flat in the nice neighborhood.
But exactly.
It's a good way to be. And it's fascinating to look back at, particularly at the moment with all the constant fear-mongering and talk of immigration and migration. I think people forget that there's been many, many times in history when immigration was sought out and migrants were sought to come to a country and requested, rather than, oh, how many can we take? It's like, this is what we need.
Yeah.
You know, they've been a key part of rebuilding societies in the UK as well. In most countries after any of the wars, in fact, that there would be a need. So not we're going to do a charity and take people. It's like, no, can you come and help us put our society back together again?
Yeah, and Pip, and there's also something else which a lot of people forget. Like I, when I interviewed my parents for the book, but also throughout my upbringing, I realized that very often, at least in Germany, the employers weren't really interested in integrating their workers. Like,
right.
For example, it wasn't in their interest that they would know what rights they had. Right,
I have
come across a lot of people who worked very hard, and very often they would do the jobs that Germans wouldn't do for that amount of money.
Yeah.
And they had no idea what rights they had. They were just working and they kept silent. And it's so I was born in Germany, but I lived for 3.5 years in Morocco with my grandmother.
Right.
And also I call her like the first feminist I met in my life.
Right.
And I believe that my grandparents played somehow a role in putting this idea of maybe becoming a journalist one day. I think they planted that seed indirectly.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was somebody who, and this is also again a totally different picture that, you know, about Muslim women than what we hear very often in societies or in the media today. So this woman, my grandmother, she was divorced 3 times. She left her husband's, by the way, and she brought up her kids on her own. She worked very hard. She was very much, you know, she was a very deeply religious and spiritual person. Mm-hmm. She was the same time, she was somebody who would not allow people to mess up with her or mess around with her.
Yeah.
And I mentioned in I Was Told to Come Alone different scenes where, for example, policemen were asking for bribes and she would basically scream and shout at them in the middle of the road. Or there was another scene where when I went to Quran school, so I got the Quran teachings in Morocco.
Yeah.
And this teacher beat me up, and I would run back home and cry. My grandmother took me back to the school and then, you know, took off her shoes and started hitting the teacher, the imam. I mean, this religious person.
Yeah.
And was also always telling me as a woman, don't think that women in Islam have no rights and don't allow people to mess around with you. So those two people, my grandfather, my grandmother, I think they planted quite a couple of seeds in who I am today.
And again, I think it's really evident there how that would influence you to be someone who has the freedom of thought to look unbiased and criticize and find the problems on both sides of an issue. So purely the combination of a Muslim and Western upbringing, but with times as tense as they are and situations as tense as they are, it's really easy for people, particularly after any kind of terrorist incident, to be very emotional and reactionary on the side that they're on. That, you know, whether it's the reaction from the West or the attack from a group with Muslim, you know, roots, but
or again,
Muslims I know, and me defending them in the same way, saying no, it's not all Muslims, it's this and that. But the key part, I think, to any solution, it's why I've been fascinated reading your work and your journey, is that it takes people from the West to analyse what's wrong with the West, why we're so easy to be radicalised against. You know, it shouldn't be. It's not easy to turn people against the quite simple good guys. Do you know what I mean? There has to be shades of grey. And equally, people from Muslim communities and societies to say, yeah, no, there are some problems within our teachings, within the Quran, within this, within that, within the interpretations, and we need to address that as well. And instantly hearing of your gran attacking the imam with a shoe and not agreeing that women are the silent part and all this, that's an example long ago of someone who has an awareness of that there should be a belief and a passion for their beliefs, but also an openness to criticize and use logic and say, no, well, that's clearly not right. Let's address that.
And you know, Pip, it's actually, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I think what I was trying to do, or what I'm trying to do in this book, and I was told to come along, is to look at the situation of radicalization from the perspective of me growing up in Germany, but also bringing in the incidents that I believe played a very big role in why we are where we are today. And there's two incidents that took place in 1979, one in Saudi Arabia, but first the one which was the return of the of Ayatollah Khomeini to Iran, which actually fueled radicalization there, and then the siege of Mecca in Saudi Arabia, where a group of radical people went into Mecca, and the whole story is in the book, but they managed, as the ulemas, the religious leaders in Saudi Arabia, were managed to basically blackmail the Saudi royal family into changing things and getting more rights, and were able to spread more a different interpretation of Islam also throughout different countries. And so both events in 1979 play a role, and then of course the war in Afghanistan. So I try to explain to the reader, we have to look at history and at what happened in the past in order to understand why we are where we are today.
Completely, yeah.
And so the regarding the imam, it's very interesting, but I just got back from Spain, where I covered the attacks in Barcelona, and I went to this area where those men who were radicalized, the men of Moroccan descent, but they spoke all better Catalan and Spanish than Arabic, because they grew up in Spain, in this area, and I realized very fast that the so-called imam was the problem, that this was a person who radicalized those young men.
Sure.
And I remembered this story of my grandmother, how she, when she realized that, you know, imams are usually people who have a lot of respect, who get a lot of respect from the community.
Yeah.
But my grandmother basically didn't care. She cared about, is this a person who respects others and who, you know, does good? Or is he not? And if he's not, he will, you know, he will get what he deserved from her perspective, be beaten up because he beat up her granddaughter. And it was so interesting because it made me realize we have still an issue. And this was also the issue in Spain. We have a man who spent several years in prison. Okay. Other people spent time in prison too. But the community in Spain had no idea. The Muslim community, when they gave his name to the authorities in Spain and said, this is a person who we want to have as an imam, the authorities, the police, nobody told them, oh, by the way, this guy was in prison before that for drugs. if they would have known, they would never have made him, the imam.
That position of power and trust.
That power and trust, because he lied to them. He lied about where he told them he had studied Islam. He spoke Arabic. A lot of people there don't speak Arabic. So they thought, okay, he must be somebody who really, truly knows the business.
Yeah.
Now, and this is one of the fundamental problems. So the Muslim community in Spain or in Ripoll, where those young men came from, they actually did what they had to do. They reported him and asked for the authorities to tell them if he's okay to be given this job.
Yeah.
Everybody said, yeah, you know, there's nothing on him, which again is a mistake apparently happened because the Spanish police didn't apparently give the information to the Catalan police. However, this guy was able to recruit so many young men who could have turned into something totally different.
Yeah.
And the problem we are facing today, and it's also whenever such an attack happens, like in Spain or when here in the UK or other places, we intend very often to look at it from as something that is coming from the outside and hitting our societies.
Yeah.
And we are not willing to look into what is actually happening within our societies. I mean, those people were radicalized in Spain. The people, all the other attackers who recently attacked here in the UK or in other places, they were radicalized in the midst of Europe.
Yeah.
So we cannot always say this is not our problem. It's a Moroccan problem or whatsoever.
Yeah, and
it is our problem.
Previous UK attacks, again, British and UK people who've been radicalized, and the backlash will always be, oh, we need to send them back to where they come from. It's like that illustrates the misunderstanding in one sentence. It's like they are where they come from.
Yeah.
The problem, as you said, is the radicalization. It's interesting to hear there the hijacking of a belief system, essentially a person who was a criminal coming in and defrauding his community to get to a position of power to be able to then control people and direct people and tell people what to do. And that's a worrying thing there, and surely can only be solved by not the further distancing or separating or segregating, but the further integrating. If the police had a greater relationship with the Muslim community there, then that bit of information wouldn't have got lost. It wouldn't have got overlooked. It would have been an integrated part of it rather than, well, here's our community, here's their community, let's get this information. If more members of the Muslim community were part of the police force, were part of the police community as well, then, you know what I mean, there would be that greater sharing of information.
It's I think the problem in the case of Spain was that apparently the authorities in Catalonia are not really cooperating that well with the authorities in Madrid. So, they have this whole question of whether it should be a separation on. And they have soon they're going to vote on that. So I had the impression that this was actually one of the bigger problems. What I found very interesting is that, and also some UK papers and other papers in Europe, again, made it into a problem that is not a European problem. They were talking about the man from Morocco, and I said, yeah, they were born in Morocco, but they grew all up here in the midst of our societies. They weren't radicalized there.
Yeah.
So we should, and this is as long as we are doing that, and it's the same, it's basically people are trying to explain it as, oh yeah, those people, they don't like our way of life. They don't like our societies, our freedom, and so on. And I'm trying to explain in I Was Told to Come Alone that, by taking the reader with me into those interviews that I have done with people, members of ISIS, of Al-Qaeda, or of the Taliban, to tell them, look, here is what they told me.
Yeah.
We may not agree with what they're saying, but at least listen to why they hate us, because 100%, that was the motivation for me to do this kind of reporting, to really go on the ground and sometimes risking my life in order to gain access to those people who don't very often speak to journalists. One of the main motivations was that I met this widow of a 9/11 victim, and her husband was a firefighter, and this widow, Maureen Fanning, She asked us journalists one day, why didn't we know that there are people out there who are hating us so much, and why do they hate us so much? Because if we know, maybe, or if we knew, maybe we could have done something to prevent this from happening. And I believe that still very often people are not willing to really have the discussions we should have.
100%. It's the confusing understanding with sympathy. It's essential to go and gain understanding with these people. That's not meaning that you're saying, oh, they're all right, or I get what you're doing, I see why you've done that. It's going, no, I want to understand why you've done that. As you said then, we may not agree, we probably won't agree, but surely gaining that understanding is better than simply standing back and saying they're the monsters. And again, it's the humanization of it, which again people will feel, well no, I don't want them to be humans. Sadly, they are humans. The old, again, the saying of we don't let monsters into our society. We let normal looking people. So again, it's what I found fascinating was the idea of going beyond these headlines and labels of these evil ISIS people and going, right, who's the human behind this? Do you know what I mean? No one, I think, is sitting there thinking, I'm evil, I'm going to do something evil today. They're going to believe that what they're doing is right, in the same way that we will believe that what we're doing is right. So surely there's a place of finding understanding there.
Yeah, absolutely, Pip. And you said something very important. This is not a book that is justifying terrorism, not at all. Yeah. I basically also say, and people who read I Was Told to Come Along, they will see that I challenge those guys quite a lot. I ask them again, difficult questions.
At great personal risk.
Great personal risk, but also in order to sometimes, make them look into the mirror. Like when they very often see themselves as the victims of the West, or, you know, that people would say there's a war against Islam going on, or these kind of arguments. And of course, they already have a whole, you know, kind of set of arguments in order to say it or to justify the way they are behaving, the way they're thinking, or the way they are acting. So, and for me, the important thing is to challenge that as well. And which I, for example, when you read the interaction I had with this ISIS commander, who was highly educated, he still is alive, so who's highly educated and who had a huge position inside ISIS. And this is a person who, younger than me, could have turned into something totally different. And he was trying to present to me this whole picture of, we are the victims, you know, this is basically, we are just reacting, they are attacking us first, so we have to. And I, in the argument, in this conversation with him, I basically are telling him, this is, you know, first of all, you came to Syria, it's not your country, you have no right to come here.
Yeah,
I mean, nobody asked you. But of course, he had his arguments ready. And he was trying to convince me that I was also kind of like a victim of discrimination. And so there was a back and forth debate going on in this car. I was, you know, I was told to come alone to this meeting, and then I had to get into a car and drive around the Turkish-Syrian border region with this guy. And then the discussion grew so heated that at some stage his right hand went up to his pocket, and knew he had his gun there, or a knife. And that was the moment I had to stop. But it's for me also important to show the reader that I'm arguing with them as well. Yeah. You know, here I am. I'm a Muslim woman, and I challenge them when they try to hijack my religion and turn it into something that they can justify their acts and their actions and the killing of innocent people with. So it's also very important for I think to explain that you can to a certain extent argue with people, but then as soon as his hand went up to his pocket, I understood you have to stop here.
Yeah, because this is the point to draw a line under it. And that must be a sharp jump back to reality as well. Because regardless of how nerve-wracking it's been to get to that situation, when you're engaged in a debate, it's probably easy to forget that this is a dangerous situation because you're having a passion. It's something that you care hugely about. It's something that's a huge part of your whole life from birth to now. And similarly, obviously, with the person you're arguing. So, yeah, that must be quite a snap back to reality to kind of go, okay, yeah, I remember where I am as such and know that this is as far as I can argue.
Absolutely, yes. And there have been some other incidents where I had similar moments. And I mean, but the book is also talking about, you know, how those guys are within their own family structure. I mean, there was the situation where I wanted to interview one of the deputies of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, right? The man who was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq,
right.
And who started with all the beheading videos. So I was in Jordan, and this person first agreed to meet and then said he couldn't make it and he had like toothache or whatsoever. And I tried to basically convince him, and through a contact person, we went to his home and he just said he wouldn't do it. And then the mother comes into the room of this man, this jihadist, right? This jihadist leader who always presented himself as like the big leader, tough leader. And then this mother comes in and I saw how his face expression, but also the way he spoke changed. And I kind of like, you know, I was in this situation where this contact person was in one corner and looked at me because he could see how I was thinking, how my thinking went.
Yeah.
And then the mother turns to me of this jihadist leader and says, oh, you know, greets me and says, well, you look so sad. What's going on? And I told her then, well, you know, I'm probably going to lose my job. And she's like, why? And I'm like, because your son, you know, he first agreed to give us the interview. No, he disagrees. He says he has some, you know, issues with his teeth. And I brought him some Advil and stuff like this.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, he says he can't make it. My colleague's on the way from the US. Big drama, big disaster. And then this mother turns to her son, this jihadist leader, and basically tells him in front of me, you have to give her this interview, otherwise I'm going to curse the day that I gave you milk from this, you know, breast.
Yeah.
And this guy was like, okay, mother, don't worry, I'm going to do it, and so on. And we got the interview. So,
that's amazing.
Of course, it's not, he never, I mean, of course, he would never have wanted me to see that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's taking, I mean, this is the it's big shot
the
leader.
Down, it's seeing the reality that this, and again, it's something that it's such an easy thing to say, but so hard to get across. That is someone's son, that is someone's, you know, relative, that is someone's brother, someone's husband, or all these other things. They can't spend their whole life in front of a camera looking angry, instigating beheadings and these horrific things. There's a human in there as well, and that's the ultimate illustration of that, of being told off by your mum and told to go and do an interview with a nice lady.
It's perfect. In this case, yes. In other cases, I have to tell you, it's very interesting also. And we are, you know, since the Barcelona attacks happened, you can actually see a huge conflict even inside families.
Right.
And it's like I have interviewed a couple of people who were radicalized in the UK, and now also in the case of those guys who did the attacks in Barcelona or who, you know, participated in them, who are part of this group. Some of those guys had huge issues inside their family, especially with the fathers.
Yeah.
Like I interviewed parents, and they would tell me, oh, you know, at some stage our sons came home and they would tell us, you have to pray more. You have to, right? You have to, their sisters, they would say you should actually cover your hair. One father was actually talking about also kind of like a conflict situation with one of his sons where the son who also got killed in Barcelona, who was one of the perpetrators, he was at home and would tell his youngest brother, you shouldn't watch TV. This is all evil. And then the father would come in and say, why are you saying this to your brother? Let him do what he wants to do. And and so you could, and those kids would tell their parents, you have no idea about Islam.
Yeah.
And the parents would say, wait a second, I studied, or I taught, my teachers taught taught me Islam in Morocco.
Yeah, yeah.
You are telling me that your wherever your teacher is here is knows better
knows
about
more
Islam
than,
more
yeah.
than the people in Morocco. So it's quite interesting. So very often there is also a conflict in within you know the families.
Yeah,
It's especially with the fathers.
It's fascinating. What do you feel are the kind of the keys to radicalization, I guess, because it is a bizarre thing how that can happen within a family that the particularly within a religious family, the father figure or parents would generally be seen as the one that's taught you everything and passed down the wisdom. So to have someone outside of that group completely take over that role to the extent that you're telling off your parents, that's a massive change and a massive switch for a young mind to take.
So in the case of this particular family, when I spoke to the father and I asked him, how religious are you actually? And he would say, well, he doesn't really pray much. He went to Spain in order to work. And I told him, so how was the relationship with your kids? And did you actually talk to them about their dreams and what they wanted to become? And he basically said, well, listen, I came to Spain to work hard. I brought the kids. I gave them food. They had a place to sleep. The place to sleep, by the way, was a small room where two brothers slept on mattresses on the floor.
Yeah.
And he said, and they had clothes and they had a chance to go to school. And I told them basically they have to go get out of, when they finish their school, they have to start working and support the family. And I was sitting there and I was thinking, okay, here you are in the midst of Europe and you have sons who growing up in a society where usually kids in that age want to, you know, talk about their dreams and they want their parents to participate to a certain extent also. And he thought that's enough, right? You give them food, you give them clothes and that's it.
Yeah.
So very often what is happening, since you asked about the reasons for radicalization, we have, if I look at the kind of characters I interviewed or I covered, sometimes it's because people are coming from broken families and they look for places or a community where they can participate in. And then recruiters understand this very well and they would play the father or the brother figure. In this case, the imam, the so-called imam, took that opportunity and engaged, interestingly, young men who came from families where the father was either was there but absent, you know, and didn't really understand his kids, or where the parents were divorced. So this imam came in and became like the father figure and the brother figure. So I often see those kind of cases.
Yeah.
It
seems very specifically targeted in that way. It's looking for a specific access and level of control, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's also, I describe a similar case of a young 16-year-old from Germany, Pero, in I Was Told to Come Alone, who got radicalized. I mean, his father was had spent a couple of years in prison. He grew up with his mother and the grandmother and the aunt. And when the father came back, there was a conflict situation. And the father was also, again, like the father of the Spanish guys, of the people in Ripoll, thought, well, I gave my kids money. They had they had everything they needed. I didn't really engage with them. So his son, got involved with a group of people who basically told him it would be a great idea to go to Syria. And through the help of different people, his parents were able to kidnap him back from Syria, more or less. And he is okay now. He's no longer involved in this. But he realizes that, or he told me also in interviews, he said, you know what, actually, those recruiters, they gave me a family.
Yeah.
They gave me, I mean, I didn't understand that I was recruited. I thought those are, you know, my friends. This is my new family. This is, you know, this is where I can discuss stuff. And then they started engaging with him in politics. And they would tell him, look, you are Muslim. We are all, you know, this is one ummah. And you have to understand Islam is under attack. And they would bring different arguments. They would say, for example, in 2003, the United States of America, the president there, as well as the president president of the UK, the prime minister of the UK, Tony Blair, went to war against Iraq and said, under the pretext of weapons of mass destructions, there were no weapons of mass destructions. And look what they have done to this country. They have handed it over to the Iranians. So there's a whole narrative that those recruiters are using. And then it goes on, Pip. They would say, so, you know, the West is preaching that they care about human rights and about that there's a rule of law. But if you look at the example of Iraq, who has paid the price for this wrong decision? And it's you know, unfortunately, we don't have these kind of discussions.
No, so, and again, that's what's fascinating there is most of those arguments that would be used are things that British people are looking back at as against as well. Generally, people look back and say that we were wrong to go into Iraq, all these things wrong. Yet, it's really something that we bring up when talking about a terrorism or radicalisation. It's like, well, if we can see that some of the things in our past are wrong, then surely you can see how others can see that to the point that they would feel the need to get involved in these groups and in these reactions and attacks.
And it's you're absolutely right. Of course, we all have, and the media as well, have discussed and debated about that the decision or the pretext under which troops went into Iraq was wrong.
Yeah.
But what were the consequences?
Yeah.
And this is, I think, where we have to understand, to some people, this what happened or the existence of consequences is a major issue, and they believe that this is that this shows how hypocrite we are as societies. And I'm trying to explain this to the readers because, you know, a lot of people think it's way too easy. They believe it's religion is the problem. And I'm trying to explain to them religion is not radicalizing people, but people are radicalizing religion.
Yeah.
And very often,
that's beautifully put, yeah.
And very often it's whether we like it or not, but we are still lacking the willingness of looking into how are we actually dealing with our own values.
Yeah.
How are we actually, we as people? And I grew up in the West. I'm a Western woman. I'm Muslim, but I work, for Western newspapers. Yeah. I risked my life several times to help, you know, to understand, but also help people see what is going on the hearts and minds of those people, because otherwise we will not find solutions.
Yeah, completely. And again, it's the lack of understanding, again, in many people in Western society, that the greatest victims of ISIS and of Al-Qaeda in numbers are Muslims and are in their own communities. So it's ridiculous to say that it's a religious issue when it's within that religion in itself. So it can't be that book is teaching people to do this or that. It's like, well, there's billions it's not teaching to do that.
Yeah.
So it can't be this clear thing that's the problem or the issue.
I describe it in the book as, I don't, first of all, I don't think it's a clash of civilizations. If you are civilized, you don't clash.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, so it's way this whole notion of describing it as, it's the religion, it's them and us. It's not that. I think we are facing today or in these days and years, unfortunately, a clash between people who would like to build bridges. And it doesn't matter what religious background you have or if you even have a religious background, because I know people who don't believe in religion and they are human beings, and I'm friends with such people. And it's about mutual respect and, the willingness to listen to each other and to understand their basic values and things that we all care about and we all try to honor. I think it's a more like a clash between those who want to build bridges and live together and those who want to actually divide us as societies. And those who want to divide us are not only ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or whatsoever. I'm also talking about populist movements.
Yeah.
And if we look at what's happening in Europe today, or also in the United States, recent protests, right, where you see people talking about others, other religious groups or groups, and in a way where you're just, you know, in my case, I sit back and I, the last book I co-authored was about a Nazi doctor.
Right.
And I sometimes, you know, think, haven't we learned?
Yeah.
We still haven't learned, really. Is it after, you know, all what happened, the hatred, the killing of innocent people, and the general knowing how poisonous generalization is, it seems we haven't learned much, and that's, I think, is the real issue we are facing. We are facing, you know, it's very important not to listen to those who find the easy answers and to look at things as a matter of black and white. If you're not with us, you're against us, and all this stuff.
Yeah, completely. And I think it's a It's definitely worth highlighting at the moment that in the past, whereas there have been conflicts between those with different religious beliefs, at present there's kind of a third brought in of those who don't have religious beliefs. And as you say, the everyone's beliefs, if used correctly and governed correctly, or just interpreted correctly, shouldn't affect anyone else and shouldn't be anyone else's business. It shouldn't matter that I may not be religious and you are. It's like that shouldn't be a conflicting point. We should be comfortable with saying, well, no, this is my beliefs.
Yeah,
they're right for me. I'm uniquely positioned to know what's right for me, because I've been me for 36 years, whereas you're uniquely positioned to know what's right and what are in your beliefs, because you've been you for that amount of time. It's crazy for me to think I should be able to tell you, oh, no, you shouldn't believe that. That's not right. So who am I to say that? Do you know what I mean? If we had more comfort in ourselves, I don't think we'd feel as much of a need to get everyone else to agree with us, and everyone has to be on the same page. If you're more comfortable with who you are and what you believe, it shouldn't matter that much what these other people believe.
Absolutely. There is also this whole question of who has the right to, you know, to decide what is right and wrong.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have all had our history lessons of how what happened during the colonialization.
Yeah.
You know, how colonializers were trying to implement their rule of law and the way they looked at the world into different societies and parts of this world. And so I think we also have to have a discussion about who has the right of defining what is right and wrong.
Completely. And that's the craziest example of all in history that gets overlooked so much by the West or by Britain, is that wasn't even a case of, as people will complain now. So, for example, the people fear mongering will say, well, there's these Muslim communities who have their own beliefs and own rules, and they want to live their way in our country. That's not what we did with colonization. We went over there, and then we didn't even want to live there. We just wanted to go home, but make sure that they lived our way. That's completely insane, you know, and it gets so overlooked that we went around the world saying, it's not that we're going to come here and live in our way. We're just going to tell you to live in our way, and then we're going to go back over here. And, you know, it's crazy.
But it weren't only Muslims. Just don't forget what happened in Amritsar, how many Sikhs were killed back then. But, you know, there's also a couple of lessons in this book for members of the Muslim community, where I'm, you know, when we talk about this whole issue of integration, or so-called integration, or being open also or going into societies with an open, you know, open mind, and to be also willing to learn from and to participate in those societies. So that's why, for example, I mentioned also how when I was a child and my parents took me back from Morocco, and you know, in Morocco I was. My grandfather was a freedom fighter. He fought, he fought against the French occupation.
Wow. Yeah.
And when he told me the stories of how he fought with his Jewish brothers, very important, with his Jewish brothers against French occupation, and how they called it a jihad. You know, it was the first time I came across the word jihad was when my grandfather talked about it. But he told me back then, we never touched any civilian, that is not allowed in jihad. You are not allowed to kill innocent people. So, you know, as a child I grew up with, like, to me jihad was my grandfather and his Jewish friends, you know, because he came from an area where there were Jews and Muslims living together, were fighting against people who were getting into the country and had, you know, and tried to implement their rule of law. So it was in their defense, but it was also with the clear rule not to kill civilians. And so when I started having those conversation with people from ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and they would talk about jihad, I would challenge them with my grandfather's words and say, you're talking bad about Jewish people or about Christians and so on, but are you aware that those people participated also in, trying to free, for example, Morocco from the French occupation or Algeria? So, and they themselves also don't want to look into the facts of history. So it's not only people in the West, but of course it's also not in the interest of all those groups to talk about, oh yeah, Jews, by the way, also participated in fighting the occupiers. And now, so that's also another, you know, example. So the book is not only talking about the people in the West, but also about people in the Muslim community should also look into the historical facts.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, so when I was brought back to Germany, I was like 4 years old and I participated in kindergarten. My parents put me in a Christian kindergarten. Yeah. So I came back from Morocco where I had my first real friend was a Jewish girl. I went to a Christian kindergarten and I learned about Jesus, and my parents would say, you know, Jesus is also a prophet in Islam. People in Christianity believe that he's the son of God. We don't do that, but he's a prophet in Islam. So they were always trying to teach me what we all had in common.
And we
celebrated Christmas. In a way that Muslims, like the Muslim family, would celebrate Christmas because they didn't want their kids to feel that they are outsiders in the kindergarten. And we participated. My parents always tried to push us back into the society.
But that's the beautiful thing there, and something I think is often lacking in the argument on both sides in integration and participation, is not participation because it's for the best, it'll make things easier out of politeness or out of duty. Participation because of the enrichment that you can get from learning from other societies and learning from other cultures. It sounds there that you were having a great time engaging in the different beliefs and communities and actions, rather than any, it's for the best if we integrate because of this or because of that. It's like, no, let's all learn and teach those societies our beliefs and even just going from food and music and fashion and all these other things. These things are wonderful to integrate and mix.
Absolutely. And since you mentioned music, I mean, I was, before I turned into like the investigative reporter, I had a music show. I mean, I was presenting a pop music show. Yeah. And so I'm like an 80s girl. So, yeah. It's really, you know, you can be Muslim and you can also be a descendant of the Prophet, and you can still also be open-minded and say, yes, it is part of our, actually, I believe, part of our belief system that we should engage with people and be open-minded. Yeah. And it's not, and we have to be careful also as Muslims not to think about the them and us. It's, you know, it's us all together. And when I live in, in a country, in a different country, I think it's very important also for the that your kids or your family, you know, can be part of the community.
Yeah.
And as you said, to learn from each other, to be willing to listen to each other, and we don't necessarily have to agree always.
Yeah.
But very often we find that you know, that there are so many things we have in common if we are just willing to also, you know, talk to each other and engage with each other.
And again, it's that thing there as well of accepting that we don't have to argue over who's right and who's wrong. We can engage. We can have these interactions and crossovers of beliefs and views and cultures.
And there's so many also bridge-building things, elements. I mean, music, since you mentioned music.
Yeah.
There are certain, you know, names that are even... I remember I interviewed once somebody from actually Al Qaeda. It's weird why I'm saying this now, but it's not in the book. But he was telling me about the time before he joined the group, and at some stage I asked him, "So did you also listen to music?" And he's like, "Oh," and then his face expression totally changed. He said, "Oh, you know, actually I loved Michael Jackson."
Amazing.
And I sat there, I'm like, right, yeah, and then and he said, yeah, and then, you know, Elton John was amazing too, and I'm like, you liked Elton John, okay? So, and then we started talking like for 5 minutes. It was as if the guy forgot that he was part of this group. Now we chatted about, you know, the music, and he was, and then he would always say, yeah, but this was before, you know, this was the time before I really understood what Islam is. And then at some stage I said to him, but where does Islam tell you that you should not like Michael Jackson and Elton John?
Yeah, yeah.
And he couldn't answer me.
Yeah.
And it was just, but it was really so interesting to see. I was able for some time to take away the mask of, like, you know, here I am, the Al Qaeda fighter, and so on,
and to
make him talk with, like, also his face expression changing about Michael Jackson and Elton John.
Yeah.
It didn't make him less dangerous,
right?
But again, there was this moment where I understood that this guy was somebody else before.
Yeah,
and what was important to me to understand then further was, why did he become who he became?
Yeah,
and
completely.
That's also what I'm trying with. I was told to come along to explain, why are people becoming who they became?
Yeah.
Why did Jihadi John or Mohammed Emwazi, who grew up in London, turn into a person who beheaded colleagues of mine?
Yeah. And Jihadi John is very much part of your story of when you were in London and kind of uncovered the identity there. So how was all that kind of at that point, particularly, as you said, with colleagues in great risk? And it must have really highlighted that what you were doing, as if it wasn't already obvious, was incredibly dangerous and risky.
So what I didn't know when I was actually in the car with those with this ISIS commander and drove along the Turkish-Syrian border region was that he was the boss of Jihadi John.
Right.
That
wow.
he had overseen the hostage program. And so the interview I did with him was took place a couple of weeks before the first beheading happened. And
wow. And
later when I found out who he was, I kind of felt, oh God, right? Then you understand even further how dangerous it could have been for me as well. And the Mohammed Emwazi or Jihadi John story is was really when you, I don't know if you read the chapter, but it was like a really surreal situation, also a work situation. It was very, very tough because it included going to a different part of Germany, getting a burner phone and a SIM card from a person, from a person who I was supposed to always go to when I had to be in touch with a specific person who I knew inside ISIS, a contact of mine. And then there were certain codes. For example, the person would tell me, are you going to jog at this specific time in the afternoon? then I knew that it was actually in the morning I was supposed to go and not jog, but go away and sure. in an open area to in order to speak to this person over this phone, the specific yeah. phone. And so what happened was I had a couple of a little bit of information about this Jihadi John, which came, which we gathered from talking to former hostages, but also I went back to my notebook and went through the interview that I did with right. Abu Yusuf, this ISIS commander,
yeah.
and started, you know, I made a list of different things. Like, for example, we knew that Jihadi John was interested in Somalia because he showed some of the former hostages videos from Somalia. I knew from the interview with Abu Yusuf that he spoke about even highly educated brothers from the UK of this and this background and that background. So I made a list. And when I spoke to this one source I had, I kind of like bluffed to this when I right. spoke to this ISIS man over the phone. And I basically made him believe that I already, that we got information and leaks about Jihadi John. And he decided, or I mean, he told me to wait and to be, and he would be back in touch. And I think he probably had to talk to somebody because he was also quite high level inside the hierarchy of ISIS. And yeah. And out of a sudden, I received like a message on this phone, and it said, you know, go to London, go and talk to a group called Cage and ask, you know, about Emwazi, the head. To do with him.
Yeah.
And this was the first time that I felt, oh my God, is this Emwazi, my Jihadi John?
Yeah,
and,
wow.
But then, you know, the journey went on, and I'm not going to give you the whole story, yeah, you know, no, because we want people to buy the book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, completely. Yeah, 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 100%.
But it's like, I mean, it was really a lot of work. It was a lot of work, a lot of... you know, double and triple checking. And then by the end of the day, we got in a situation where I think some parts of the British authorities didn't want us to release the name. And yeah. And we felt later that they were trying to leak the name to some British colleagues so that it yeah. wouldn't be the Washington Post.
Right, I see.
Running
yeah, yeah,
the name
yeah, yeah.
first. So, yeah.
It's fascinating and engaging, but every now and then I have to remind myself that you're, and again, it might be something that you have to remind yourself, that you're a journalist. Yeah. You're not working for the government. You're not a secret agent or whatever
not.
Else, but you're doing, you know, the work of that in place in a situation like that where you're having to bluff and to try and get information. Do you ever have to remind yourself when you're in these situations and talking to these people that you're there to gain understanding and information rather than to convince them or win them over or anything else? Because, you know what I mean, when you're having those arguments or discussions and it's your belief system, you're defending it, obviously we discussed the point when he reaches for a gun is the point to stop that conversation. But is that something you ever feel, that you feel you're an urgency to convince them of why they're wrong and what's wrong, when that's not necessarily your role in that situation?
Mm. No, it's not about convincing, but it's about challenging. Mm. And it's my part, it's my job, it's part of my job to challenge people and to look behind the mask.
Yeah.
And I don't have to remind myself because I know I'm a journalist. My job is to do my level best in order to get the best possible information and truth for the readers.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm doing. So I'm not, I don't work for governments, and
yeah.
I have probably written a lot of pieces that yeah, I pissed off a lot of governments.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And all sides, by the way. I also was in situations, and I'm describing this in the book, where I was under threat myself and had been threatened by different people, by, on one hand, activists from, you know, for example, in Bahrain, who didn't like my reporting, and then again from people who were members later by ISIS, who
yeah.
didn't like my reporting. So, yes, there's a lot of, there's a sometimes a price you pay when you do this kind of job, but it's also, and it's not about convincing. I'm not there to convince people. It's not that. It's about challenging, but it's part of my job. I cannot just go into an interview and listen to, I'm not a PR person, right? Yeah. I'm not there to just listen and basically give, you know, write an article
pass
which
on
is
a,
based
a message as such,
yeah exactly yeah. I'm not this is not my this is not my job yeah. My job is to really challenge people and to also look into to argue with them, and it doesn't necessarily mean that I want to convince them. It's just about really, you know, doing my job of asking critical questions to all sides.
And again, it's as essential for anything you're working on to ask that question as it is for to challenge them to justify their actions as such. Because if no one is asking these critical questions, if they're just being told by this person the whole time, here's what we need to do, then it's important to go, why? And why that? And why is it this part that we're ignoring and this part that we're paying attention to, rather than ignoring that part and paying attention to this part? Because again, it's always such ancient and historical teachings that do change and will be certain bits completely ignored and certain bits completely, well, that's what it says, we have to follow it by the by the letter.
Yes, and you know, Pip, it's also by you know, when let me give you an example. I sat with a person who was an ISIS recruit, and this kid didn't even, because he was a kid, he was not even 18, he couldn't even read Arabic. And then I told him, and he would give me, you know, he would give me the narrative his recruiter gave him, oh, there's a war against Islam, and you know, and we have to defend ourselves, and those are the unbelievers, and this whole thing. And then at some stage I said to him, okay, listen, explain to me, so you don't read Arabic, right? No, I don't read Arabic. And I said to him, so explain to me, how is it possible that you are saying, you calling those people unbelievers if the Prophet called them the members of the book religions, and that, and then he looked at me, he said, what do you mean? I said, you say unbelievers, you call Jewish and Christian people unbelievers, while the Prophet, in whose name you're doing all this, called them the members of the book religion. The Quran talks about the members of the book religion, and those people, you know, there are certain rules that they have the right to, you know, to live on, and you know, and so on. He couldn't answer me that. He couldn't also answer me when I told him, when he said that he felt the need to go and fight jihad. I said to him, but you know, there's this story of the Prophet where a young man went to him and said, I want to fight jihad. And then the Prophet asked him, do your parents still live? And he said, yes. And then this young man was told, then you can fight jihad by taking care of them, by looking after them.
Wow.
So, and he didn't know all this because guess what? He doesn't know Arabic. Of course, his recruiter doesn't tell him this kind of stories.
Or what easier a person to radicalize than someone who can't literally can't question it because of that lack of being able to research it themselves.
Exactly. And so if I have the knowledge of challenging them, and I'm asking the same questions to recruiters. I have sitting with people, with preachers who were preaching in the UK. I mean, Omar Bakri Mohammed, who was basically the spiritual father of all those people from groups such as Al-Muhajirun and others that are very known in the UK. It is my job to challenge people. It is my job to ask these questions, because, you know, when you have the knowledge and you don't, and people are claiming that they're doing this in the name of the religion, then I need to ask them.
Yeah.
But I asked also when I covered so-called born-again Christians, you know, I covered also born-again Christian movements. And trust me, some of those people are not less dangerous than some of the other people that I interviewed. And I asked them about Christianity as well, because yes, I've been to a Christian kindergarten, and yes, I did read the New, you know, Testament and the Bible as well, because it's part of my job to ask critical questions.
Yeah, of course.
It doesn't mean that I want to convince them or whatsoever. But it's part of my article. It's important to also explain to the reader this is who I'm talking to.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is really how much knowledge the person has.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I laid it out there. Like, here's what I said. This is where it's... Well, I'll start to wrap things up now. The last thing I want to kind of discuss, for anyone of my generation at least, the turning point and pinnacle of everything that's been going on over these years was 9/11. That was an unforgettable moment in our history. And again, it caused great waves on both sides. It meant that the West kind of almost had free rein to go and attack, or feel they had free rein to go and attack where they wanted to attack, even if it was unrelated to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or anything else. So how do you think things have or do you feel since then the issue has increased or decreased? Because it's such a hard one to gauge from the outside, because are we becoming desensitized because there's more attacks? Are we hearing more because of the internet and social media and things being that bit more accessible and shareable if it's the right headline and the right story? How do you feel we are at this point in that conflict, I guess?
So, you know, when we the interesting thing is, when we talk about the West, we sometimes forget to remember that we have a lot of Muslims who are Westerners as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's so to me, 9/11 was also one of those key moments, because I was, as soon as I learned that some of those 9/11 pilots had lived in Hamburg, where I visited journalism school, I was in deep shock.
Yeah.
And I needed to understand why they turned into, mass murderers and how this was possible. And here again, I think we forget that they got radicalized in Europe, in Hamburg, yeah, and not in Egypt or in the United Arab Emirates or in Lebanon, where they came from. They came as students and they were radicalized in the midst of Hamburg, in the, yeah, society where I visited my journalism school. I didn't get radicalized, but they went into certain neighborhoods and got involved with certain people, recruiters who were able to basically brainwash them.
Yeah.
Now, where are we today? I think when I look at the fact that we have not only Al-Qaeda, but we have ISIS, we have so many other groups now, yeah, when I see what the outcome is of the so-called Arab Spring, where people again looked at the things as, oh yeah, those protesters, they all want democracy, yoo-hoo, we are all in for that, right? Yeah. And people didn't want to really look into what the reality that happened on the ground, and the whole question of, if somebody talks about democracy, are they talking about the values that we consider as democratic values, or are they talking about implementing voting system, which, yeah, is different, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think we are doing quite well, if you ask me. I think people got, to a certain extent, used to this whole, those incidents where people are taking knives and believe and just stab others in the name of ISIS or whatsoever. I think people got kind of like used to it, but in Europe at least. But I'm afraid that we haven't seen the worst yet.
Yeah.
But you said something during the last half an hour, which is absolutely true and accurate and important to always remember. What we are witnessing here, the attacks that we are witnessing in Europe, is maybe 1% of what people in Iraq, yeah, and Syria and other places have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And also to always remember, this is not a fight or a war or a conflict between Islam and the rest or what. This is a conflict between people who turned into joined an ideology for whatever reason, that which I'm describing in the book,
yeah,
but joined an ideology that believes that any person, no matter what religion this person has, who has a different set of beliefs and who does not sign up for their set of beliefs is an enemy. So what we are witnessing here in Europe is maybe 1, 2, or 3% of what people in Iraq and Syria are witnessing every day who have to live under such groups.
Completely. And that's that alone very clearly illustrates that it's not a war against our way of living or our way of life. If it was, it'd be higher than a few percent affecting the West as such. It's a radicalization of a religion and a belief system.
And we should not forget that there are a lot of people who are doing those kind of actions in, and who have been doing them in the last couple of years in Iraq and in Syria, who are British citizens, German citizens, Dutch citizens, French citizens, Belgium citizens.
Yeah.
And of course, now the big question is what should happen with them, because some of those people want to return. And of course, I mean, they are citizens of European countries, and they were radicalized in Europe. So they are, of course, also our problem.
We
will have to deal with them. They're not the problems of the Iraqis or the Syrians, because those people got radicalized in the midst of our societies. And I don't think we have the discussions, and we are still not willing to look inside our societies in order to prevent the reasons for radicalization. And that's what worries me.
Yeah, yeah. As I said, it does feel it's. I mean, you touched upon earlier that anyone that the fear should be of listening to anyone that seems to paint it as a black and white a scenario, and that's, I think, from the book and from our discussion, it couldn't be clearer that it's not that. It is an issue that, similarly with most big issues in societies. I mean, we touched briefly on America, but the rise of the far right is, it's not an issue that, it's not a white issue or a black issue. It's an issue that everyone needs to get involved in. A simple quote in a racist society, it's no longer enough to simply not be racist. You have to be anti-racist. You have to be against this. But again, it takes action on all sides. It takes action from the Muslim community. It takes action from the labeled West, you know, whoever that may be, because the Muslim community in there as well. But it takes action from all sides. It's a sadly complex situation. But again, I love the fact that we can have these conversations. And as said, I urge people to grab I Was Told Not to Come Alone. It's available now all over the place. So yeah, thank you very much for I mean, number one, in a small way, for having this conversation, but in a far grander way, for all the conversations that you've put your life at risk to have in your career so far.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Pip.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. I mean, what did I tell you? I warned you this was... I've been hyping this one for a couple of weeks and saying it's a pretty special one. I hope you agree. I think you will agree. As I said at the start, I hope you're all up for sharing this and pushing this on word of mouth and social media. This isn't one that is going to be the front page of iTunes and things like that, like episodes with Eddie Izzard or Aisling Bea or whoever else, any other big names. But it's one that should be, and it's one that will rely on your word of mouth and your passionate screaming it from the rooftops to get this out there. So yeah, hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was amazing. Next week I'm joined by Hugo White from the Maccabees. A wonderful conversation, the first time we'd met, and we just hit it off massively. I could have chatted to him for hours and hours. So yeah, hope you enjoy that one. And we also talk about the fact that everyone thinks I wasn't aware of this until some people mocked me on social media, that everyone thinks I name drop Adele or Kate Nash or whoever else are loads. It's not true. It's just I happen to talk to people from back in the day when we all used to gig. It's not, I mean, whatever. Just leave it, all right? Speaking of leaving stuff, if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes, rate and review us. I hear from listening to other podcasts that that's a big deal and we really care about that. I've never looked at my reviews. I don't really know. I don't know if it makes a difference. They say it helps advertisers or sponsors or something. I don't know. Don't bother. Don't rate and review. Go and rate and review Hardcore Listing or Say Why to Drugs or Stop and Search or Tuesday Night Jaw instead of Distraction Pieces Podcast. Just do that. I don't care. I don't want your reviews. I mean, yeah, I do want them, actually. I've changed my mind. Can you go and review this? Can you go and rate and review, please? That would be cool. In fact, don't rate and review. Don't do any of that. Just go online or into a bookshop and order Soad McHenett's I Was Told to Come Alone book and read that, digital or physical. Yeah, check it out. I'm just going to talk for ages at the end now. I've been reading James Acaster's book recently, and it's my reading for when I'm going in and out of London for stuff, and every time I've picked it up and had that journey, I've laughed out loud. I've not lolled, I've actually laughed out loud. Not that loud. Audible, but not that loud. Maybe not audible over the noise of a train. But I have laughed. I think it's a great book and it's making me chuckle. So yeah, check that out. I'm going to go now and I'll be back next week. See you later. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.